Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Today, a special presentation, one that I had hoped would have been done from scientists within the vaccine and immunization community, but has not been done. Recently, I was listening to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who spoke about the dangers of COVID. Post facto, now we can look back. Now almost 300 articles published in respected journals, including The Lancet, have been rescinded, because they were inaccurate, and frequently from bad science, corporate scientists, science for hire. But Robert said that he was fully pro-vaccine. He had gotten the vaccines, all of his children gotten all their vaccines, but it was this vaccine that was of concern. I heard the same thing similarly said by almost all the major advocates who are now challenging what we learned about COVID that was not true. And because of that, their reputations have been substantially destroyed. But they're still pro-vaccine. So today's presentation is unique, and it's different. It's based upon pure scholarship. There is no personal commentary. There is no bias. All the information I'm about to share, which is fully referenced, fully footnoted, comes from the National Library of Medicine and peer-reviewed journals. And it questions whether or not we have been telling the public the truth for 100 years, that the vaccines they're receiving are both proven safe and effective, that occasionally may have some little blip, something goes wrong, but that's an isolated case. Is that true? Do we have the real peer-reviewed literature showing that these studies on vaccines were done properly? Or is this more science for hire? That's what we're going to explore now. If there's one overarching message that has come from the scientists and physician whistleblowers who have informed and warned us about COVID-19 vaccines over the past 3 years, from people who are formerly esteemed within the medical establishment and who believe in vaccines and use them in their own medical practices, is that the COVID vaccines have been shown to be neither safe nor effective. How could so many people get it so wrong? That is the question. All the so-called original science used to justify their rapid release mandate for the world's entire population has now been shown to be faulty and inaccurate in the information shared. At this time, we're seeing many peer-reviewed articles published by independent scientists showing that virtually everything that we were instructed to do and which we obeyed was incorrect. The latest count of those injured or dead from Edward Dowd and a group of PhDs and scientists associated with him indicates that about 12 million people in the United States have been injured by the COVID-19 vaccines. Over 1.2 million had serious injuries, some permanent, and 300,000 people are dead just in the United States. In 1976, with the promotion of the swine flu epidemic and the rush for a vaccine, there were 20 people dead out of 40 million vaccinated, and the vaccines were immediately halted and taken off the market. But now we have a very unusual phenomena. The VAERS system, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, reporting to which is voluntary, not mandatory, has been grossly understating injuries and mortalities with respect to COVID-19 vaccines. Therefore, there is no accurate government accounting on those figures. How do we know this? Besides the revelations from the Harvard Pilgrim study, Dr. Jessica Rose and others who have reported on the shortcomings of the VAERS system, the media has been unwilling to interview nurse and physician whistleblowers from the medical system, including those in emergency rooms, hospitals, and nursing homes who have witnessed firsthand and are continuing to witness injuries and deaths that have not been reported to VAERS or the reporting systems of other countries. These people have bravely spoken out about this, risking their jobs and their livelihoods. Many of these whistleblowers tell us that they were threatened and actually lost their jobs for reporting these injuries and deaths. They tell us there have been widespread sanctions for medical professionals who want to report accurate data to the government agencies. The CDC, the FDA, the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, and the World Health Organization have refused to provide in-depth, accurate information on injuries and death. Indeed, the government continues to act as if none of the hundreds of independent studies showing the dangers of COVID-19 vaccines and their lack of efficacy were ever published. And all of us who have known what is happening have been horrified to see it go on before our eyes. It has been an awakening for many of us to see the corruption and greed that can overtake an otherwise altruistic profession, which exists to help people and save their lives. It has been chilling to see our friends and colleagues deceived, people we trust, whom we have known to be good people trying to do good work, participate in what is now apparent are crimes against humanity. But is this really the first time this story has been told? Many of us may think, yes. But many of us also believe that vaccines are generally safe and effective. Maybe an odd one is not. It'll be corrected. The government or its regulatory agencies, like the FDA or CDC, will pull it from the market. Not true. We're inclined to think that this is the exception. The story of vaccine safety and efficacy, of vaccine's role in saving lives, has been told to us repeatedly, often by the same voices now promoting the COVID vaccines, certainly the same agencies, trying to assuage us that they really are safe and effective. And shame on you for not getting your vaccines, your child their vaccines, your senior citizen their vaccines, and for you even questioning it. As a result, we have not questioned it. It is just something we've taken for granted, that if it was any way problematic, we wouldn't be offered the vaccine. We certainly wouldn't be mandated it. So they're trying to convince us that the mounting tally of deaths and injuries do not exist. These are not real figures, but they are. Many of us may think that the tragedy unfolding as a result of the authorization of the COVID-19 vaccines is an aberration in an otherwise clean and successful history of the use of vaccines to promote and protect public health. But is this true? As it turns out, a great deal of evidence suggests otherwise. What if the massive atrocity committed through the global use of COVID-19 vaccines were just one more chapter in a long history of the misrepresentation of the safety and efficacy of vaccines and the cover-up of the deaths and injuries that have followed in their wake? If you follow the trail of evidence, and it's good quality peer-review evidence, also from lawsuits and also from Freedom of Information Act released documents, whistleblower statements, physicians, and personal testimonials, it begins to look as if this scenario is not new at all. It has played itself out over and over and over again. The question we should be asking ourselves as we cope with the weight of the problem we are facing is, was it true that the vaccines we had accepted before COVID were safe and effective? They did a good job, yes. Or did they do harm? No. We're going to explore that now. We believe it is time for the pediatricians, obstetricians, family doctors, and groups who have historically supported the use of vaccines to stop for a moment and ask themselves one basic and fundamental question. What if they, well-meaning, were given this information by intent? What if good science was excluded and corporate proprietary and science for hire were used in its place? Have they been comprehensive in their scholarship? Have they come to honest and objective research conclusions that the results of many of these vaccines, including those on an annual vaccine schedule for children, are what they were told, safe and effective? They're all recommended, including the flu vaccine. What I'm about to share with you represents more than 30 years of research on this topic, including an in-depth examination of the toxicological data and a look at how many vaccines have undergone clinical trials evaluating active vaccines against a placebo or inactive, like a saline solution, in which the vaccine is simply salt water instead of another vaccine. But weren't all vaccines tested against a saline solution? Think for a moment. The answer is no, they were not. More often than not, they were tested against another vaccine. Well, then you don't have any standard of quality. This is not to embarrass anyone. We've been told a story that wasn't true and propagandized, and we believed it. This is not a crime, but now that we have seen what can happen when a set of false beliefs guides decision-making for global public health, we need to look more deeply to discover the whole truth about all vaccines. The following information is meant to offer a broader understanding of the way the collective hubris, which has taken root within the medical and scientific community, has blinded us from seeing the truth hidden behind deceptive scholarship, elevated through tenacious marketing to the position of the gold standard in medicine. But it is lead. It is not gold. There is no standard. What we're presenting are just a few examples from tens of thousands of articles that exist. And now and throughout history, we have not been told about the truth. Let us begin. Our first vaccine is the whooping cough, the diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus vaccine, and its safety and efficacy in controlling pertussis, or whooping cough. Has it been effective? The late Vincent Fulgigini, MD, a noted pediatrician and spokesperson for the American Academy of Pediatrics, wrote, quote, "Prior to the widespread use of pertussis vaccine, both the incidence of pertussis and the case fatality ratio declined, a 50-fold reduction in the incidence and an 84% reduction in case fatality recorded in Great Britain in the years between 1947 and 1972. This data suggests that pertussis virulence was declining before the pertussis vaccine and that the incidence of the disease continued to fall, both before and after the introduction of the vaccine. To further complicate the analysis of the efficacy of the vaccine, several studies have shown results varying from no effect at all through 20% protection, up to 80% protection," end quote. Vaccine researcher Harris Coulter points out that the decline in fatalities from pertussis parallels declines in other infectious diseases, scarlet fever, measles, influenza, tuberculosis, and typhoid. Coulter notes that these declines occurred alongside improved sanitation, better nutrition, better housing, cleaner water, resulting in overall health, and cannot be attributed to max vaccination programs. In addition, antibiotics, which were successful in controlling secondary infections such as pneumonia and bronchitis, improved a child's likelihood of surviving whooping cough. So there is no doubt about the efficacy of the DTE vaccine. It may not have been responsible in controlling pertussis at all. But what about its safety? That's a separate issue. In the late 1940s, doctors and government health officials campaigned strongly for mass immunization against pertussis. There have been no studies on its safety or efficacy, so the push to vaccinate American children was an entirely experimental undertaking. In the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, there were reports of pertussis vaccine toxicity. All along, the reports were there, and vaccination continued in spite of the negative effects. In 1933, a doctor reported two infants had died immediately after vaccination. Other reports were of children who develop high fevers, convulsions, and collapse. In 1948, two Harvard researchers followed 15 children who had severe reactions within 72 hours of vaccination. All had been normal prior to the vaccines. Over 8 months of the 15 children, only one recovered during the period of observation. Only one. Among the symptoms suffered by the other children were convulsions, blindness, deafness, spasticity, helplessness, damaged nervous systems, and, quote, a long downhill course ending in death, end quote. But what of other children all over America who were not studied? What happened to them? How did the state of their health be altered? Months or years later, no one knew. There was no follow-up study. So now, can we say that the vaccine at least had efficacy and safety? No, we cannot on either count. And how do you account for over 90%, 95% of the people taking a vaccine ending up disabled or dead and not be a big red flag? But it wasn't. According to vaccine researcher Harris Kolder, author of A Shot in the Dark, while severe reactions such as mental retardation and convulsive seizures and paralysis may affect only a small minority, other reactions go unrecognized. Children may develop chronic infections, behavioral problems such as hyperactivity. They may be slow in develop and have learning disabilities. The reports and studies of DPT toxicity grew over the years. In 1953, a list of 82 cases of pertussis vaccine damage was put together. In 1958, 170 such cases were documented in the medical literature. 31 of these showed signs of permanent damage. Between 1946 and 1957, large-scale studies conducted in Britain showed a significant number of children suffered from convulsions after receiving the vaccine. Though a connection to the vaccine was denied by the medical establishment, from this study, the British and American medical communities both concluded that vaccines were safe. How could they have done that? That was not based upon science or observation or medical outcome. That was based upon politics and profits. In 1960, a Swedish researcher stated, quote, the incidence of neurological complications after pertussis does not appear to be as high as that after vaccination. So the vaccine was worse than the disease itself, end quote, after the vaccines. And he noted the decrease in the severity of the disease itself. He concluded, quote, it is questionable whether universal vaccination against it is justified. In 1961, an American physician recognized a reluctance on the part of parents to bring their children in for further DPT vaccinations because of violent reactions to prior shots. He collected data from 52 cases and found 6 had collapsed, 14 had persistent vomiting, 13 uncontrolled screaming. These reports did not stop the American medical establishment and government health authorities. And by the mid-1950s, the vaccination program was in full swing. In 1974, British physicians released a report on their study of 36 cases of neurological illness thought to be attributable to the vaccine. Of these cases, 2 died, 4 recovered completely, 1 was permanently paralyzed on one side, 4 were mentally retarded, 3 had epilepsy, and 22 were retarded and had epilepsy. The report was the basis of a television program and is believed to have triggered the dramatic decline in vaccination from 80% to 30% of British schoolchildren over the succeeding 4 years. That same year, another British researcher estimated that an average of 80 cases of severe neurological damage resulted in the pertussis vaccine annually. It was not until 1978 that the Food and Drug Administration, the agency responsible for monitoring the safety of drugs in this country, commissioned its first study. Mind you, this vaccine had been in effect for a long time. This was the first DPT study, and some 30 years after it had been in widespread use here, and a good 10 years after most states had passed legislation requiring pertussis vaccination for entry into school. The 2-year study conducted at UCLA was like so many other medical investigations in that it was riddled with statistical manipulations, misleading statements, and unwarranted conclusions. The FDA, University of California, study showed a significant number of adverse reactions to the DPT vaccine, but through the magic of statistical manipulation, downplayed the importance of these often severe reactions, include a quote, "This study supports the conclusion of others that the benefits of pertussis immunization far outweigh the risks," end quote. The flaws in this study were easily detectable. The data was compiled in terms of numbers of vaccines, not numbers of children who received them. Remember, DPT is a multiple injection. This resulted in a much larger denominator against which adverse reactions were measured. Children in the study were pre-screened for any conditions that might predispose them to such responses. So you take anyone that might have an adverse reaction out of the study. Then you're only dealing with healthy children. But what about who gets the vaccine? Well, everyone gets the vaccine, including those children who had pre-existing conditions that were not allowed in the study. That's a fraudulent study at every level. In doing so, this study failed to replicate normal distribution of the vaccine in the general population. The study did not recognize high-pitched screaming as an adverse reaction, even though many physicians considered it a symptom of central nervous system irritation. Follow-up on children who showed severe reaction was limited to just 2 weeks. That's it. 2 weeks. And we know that some reactions take 2 years and many months to develop. Again, was this intentional? They didn't recognize reactions that occurred more than 48 hours after the actual injection. In attempting to estimate the total number of children who have been damaged by the vaccine, Harris-Calder said, quote, "We concluded that a number of children die from the vaccine. There are about 9,000 cases of sudden infant death per year in the United States. The vaccine authorities admit that they can't tell the difference between a case of a child dying from vaccination and the case of a child dying from some other cause. So they are both classified as sudden infant death from unknown causes. So the question is, how many of these cases of sudden infant death might be due to the vaccine? We estimated. It's really difficult to tell how accurate the estimate is. That probably there is a quarter to a half were caused by the vaccine. The same may be true of children with epilepsy. There are 25,000 children born every year in the United States who are diagnosed as being epileptic from birth. But those children are first diagnosed after each has had 4 DPT shots already. Since it's been reported that DPT vaccine can cause seizures and epilepsy, how many cases of infant epilepsy are congenital and how many are really caused by the vaccine? Nobody really knows, end quote. Then in 1986, we got the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. But these red flags did not slow the vaccine manufacturers or medical establishment in the drive to vaccinate America's children. Instead, the vaccination lobby grew. The lobby persuaded Congress, after lots of funds went to the congresspersons, to fund the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986, which assigned the financial responsibility for illnesses caused by the vaccine to the U.S. government rather than the vaccine manufacturers. Dr. Anthony Morris, a research scholar who spent more than 30 years studying vaccines at the National Institutes of Health and the FDA, testified to a House subcommittee prior to its being passed, saying, "My urgent plea to members of this committee is do not fund the compensation program of the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986. This program, in my judgment, will be found to be a black hole for taxpayers' dollars, to be an escape from just responsibility by manufacturers, medical practitioners for their product and their practices, and to be an injustice to children who will be irreparably harmed by mandating vaccine injections," end quote. It was passed in spite of that. Let's take a look at another vaccine, the swine flu vaccine. The swine flu vaccine that I mentioned earlier, that was in 1976, 10 years before it was legislated that American taxpayers would foot the bill for vaccine company malfeasance. The Justice Department reported that 6 years after the end of the swine flu program, 1,571 lawsuits had been filed against the federal government for compensation, which it agreed to provide when the insurance industry deemed it too big a risk. 290 suits were settled for $57 million, An additional 693 were still pending, with total compensation of over $1 billion being sought by plaintiffs. And was this vaccine administered to millions of Americans justified by panic over a visible public health onslaught of an extremely dangerous and deadly disease? How deadly was the swine flu of 1976 to justify it being called an epidemic and a rush to get the vaccine to everyone's arms? The swine flu struck America when, in 1976, Private David Lewis collapsed and died in a matter of hours at Fort Knox, New Jersey. His death was traced to a virus that was related to swine flu. Some medical authorities feared that this was just the first case of what could turn out to be a new epidemic of the disease. In the year after Lewis's death, no other similar fatalities were reported. A nationwide search turned up a few isolated cases. Does that sound familiar? As we've seen, lawsuit payouts were accumulating in the ledgers of vaccine makers, and this was handily transferred to the American taxpayer through the 1986 National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. What happened after the establishment of the 1986 National Childhood Injury Act? Did this slow down the rate of injuries based upon how many vaccines were shown to be dangerous? No. One of the stipulations of this law was for injury surveillance to behave as an early warning system, which resulted in the establishment of the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. Monitoring of injuries through this system began in 1990, and one might think that vaccine injuries must have been very low then, or even childhood vaccination could not have continued and grown as to it has today. Well, actually, in 1991 and 1994, 38,787 adverse reactions following vaccination reported VAERS, according to October 1997 article in the Journal of Pediatrics. Most of these reports occurred within 2 weeks after vaccination. These reactions included less serious reactions as well as deaths. This is what the early warning system told us, and we paid no heed to it. People were dying, permanently injured, and we chose not to give it any credibility. Not only are these numbers a fraction of the actual numbers, since all along VAERS has been underreporting and only actually reporting approximately, according to a Harvard study, 1 to 2%, the most 3%. So there is no accurate short-term data. This data does not account for long-term complications or illnesses with the late onset. A recent review of the VAERS data conducted by Columbia University estimated that there were upwards of 187,000 vaccine-related deaths during a seven-month period between February and August 2021. Did you see this article in any media at all? The answer is no. It was reported openly in a press conference by the CDC. No. This is a 20-fold increase over the CDC's figures. The Columbia researchers expressed their greatest concern about vaccinating children. Quote from the study, "The risks of COVID vaccines and boosters outweigh the benefits in children, young adults, and older adults with low occupational risk or previous coronavirus exposure," end quote. Again, that should have been sent to every pediatrician, every obstetrician, every internist, every doctor, every pharmacist, every nurse, every hospital, every school teacher. It was sent to no one. They also concluded that the VAERS system is unsuited for estimating life-threatening events or vaccine-induced death rates. On the CDC's webpage for VAERS, among all the written text, only two phrases are highlighted in bold. Quote, "A report to VAERS does not mean that a vaccine caused an adverse event." And, quote, "VAERS data alone cannot determine if the vaccine caused the reported adverse event." That is the relationship CDC chooses to emphasize regarding the role a vaccine may have played in causing an injury. But if the sum of these reports means nothing conclusive, what is the system for? Of course, the Verus system is not the only sector from which emergence evidence that vaccines are causing harm. Another source of information is the vaccine lawsuit awards. According to the records of the vaccine court set up in the Justice Department under the 1986 Act, as of 2019, over $4 billion has been paid out since its launch. But there is another early warning system that has been entirely ignored by the arbiters of public health. The push is to, quote, believe all women, end quote, when they speak of their experience of sexual assault has, for some reason, not taken hold with respect to their accounts of their own children regressing into autism after vaccination. Over 2 million mothers have watched as their beautiful, healthy, vibrant children, babies and toddlers, who were curious, speaking, learning new words, making eye contact, smiling, laughing, in other words, who were developing normally, suddenly, shortly after a routine appointment with their pediatricians, stop speaking, stop making eye contact, stop responding to external stimuli, had low effect, seemed uncomfortable and unhappy, and were subsequently diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. Why is it that it has been so difficult for us to believe these women, but not even a lobby, not an organized group of political activists with an agenda, but individual women have the same experience all over the country? Why do we feel skeptical, feel a barrier go up inside of us when someone begins to say the words autism and vaccine in the same sentence? The science doesn't support a connection, we're told. But what does the science actually show if you choose to look at the actual science? Well, according to the CDC, as of March 2023, the rate of autism is 1 in 36 children. But in 2018, the rate of autism was 1 in 44 children. But even decades ago, in June of 2000, autism rates were skyrocketing, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was trying to find out why. He came upon a transcript released through the Freedom of Information Act request of the secret Simpson-Wood Conference for Scientific Review of Vaccine Safety Data Link for Information. It was held in 2000 in Norcross, Georgia. This conference, including top officials only, in secret, from the FDA, the CDC, the British Health Ministry, and top pharmaceutical executives. And it was held to discuss the results of a major study evaluating the negative effects of thimerosal, a mercury-based preservative used in vaccines, present in over 30 U.S. licensed vaccines. To put things in perspective, these were not trace amounts of ethyl mercury, which were being injected in children. If a mother followed the vaccine schedule recommended by the CDC, depending upon the manufacturer of the vaccine, infants were receiving doses of between 0.0 to 187.5 micrograms of ethyl mercury. Total exposure over 18 months could be as high as 237.5 micrograms. The EPA advises how much? 0.1 microgram per kilogram per day is a maximum dose of ethyl mercury. So if an 11-pound infant received all their thimerosal-containing vaccines at a two-month visit, her exposure on that day would be 62.5 micrograms of ethyl mercury. That's 125 times the EPA guidelines. So did the FDA show concern? Did the EPA show concern? Did the National Academy of Sciences get involved? No. At the Simpson-Wood Conference, a Dr. Tom Verestraten, an epidemiologist from the CDC, presented his findings to a group concluding, quote, the screening analysis suggests a possible association between certain neurological developmental disorders, namely tics, attention deficit disorder, speech and language disorders, and the exposure to mercury from thimerosal-containing vaccines before the age of 6 months, end quote. And what happened next? Did the experts in the tent say, quote, we have to take these off the market immediately? If this is true, we've made a terrible mistake and we owe the public an apology and reparations? No. the conference transcript documents that the people in attendance speak over one another with questions trying to minimize the results. That World Health Organization Director John Clements expressed doubt that the study should have been conducted at all since, quote, the outcome of it could have, to some extent, been predicted. How we handle it from here is extremely problematic. Let's go back. The head of the World Health Organization is saying the results could have been predicted? You meaning all these children ending up with autism spectrum disorder and other tics from the vaccines? Is that what you're predicting? Then the doctors agreed, quote, to embargo the information so nobody can see it, no news media, no one, until a meeting is scheduled for later that month, and they never release it at all. Vera Stratton's study wasn't published until 3.5 years later in 2003, but only after the conclusion was rewritten. His original conclusion had pointed to a causal relationship between ethyl mercury from thimerosal-containing vaccines administered in the first month of life and neurological development impairment in children, and called for further confirmatory studies. But the rewritten conclusion states, quote, no consistent significant associations were found between thimerosal-containing vaccines and neurodevelopmental outcomes. Conflicting results were found at different HMOs for certain outcomes. For resolving the conflicting findings, studies with uniform neurodevelopmental assessments of children with a range of cumulative thimerosal exposures are needed, end quote. But that's exactly opposite what his own studies and reported and released to the attendees at this secret conference. Now, if I can find that information, if Robert Kennedy Jr. can find it, why can't a single news story, a single at any 60 Minutes, Dateline, Nightline, 2020, New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, why couldn't they do an investigative report on this? If they had done this, this is Pulitzer Prize winning material for them. Not a single journalist took this on. We did, I did at the time. But who's listening to me or others? No one. But that's just one study, right? Actually, those data were from Vera Stratton's fourth attempt to conduct a study that would produce results showing no correlation between thimerosal and childhood neurological problems. The first three studies stubbornly also showed a correlation. In an email to a colleague, Vera Stratton wrote, quote, I do not wish to be an advocate of the anti-vaccine lobby and sound like being convinced that thimerosal is or was harmful, but at least I feel we should use sound scientific argumentation and not let our standards be dictated by our desire to disprove an unpleasant theory, end quote. So, if the media had chosen to look, if Congress had had hearings on this, they would have found that there were four straight studies by Vera Stratton showing autism spectrum disorder. All that has been hidden. A report by Safe Minds published in October 2003 documents how the CDC developed and modified the protocol for its vaccine safety data link study between 1999 and 2003. So by the end of 2003, four generations of modifications had been made, each time, quote, subtle but powerful changes, end quote, were made to its original study protocol so that, quote, troubling findings were obscured. Let me repeat that, quote, troubling findings were obscured or made less significant, end quote. Is that malice aforethought? Is that obstruction of justice? Is that hiding information? The evidence of foul play in the case of thimerosal was also documented by Brian Hooker, PhD, and his colleagues in their 2014 article titled Methodological Issues and Evidence of Malfeasance in Research Purporting to Show Thimerosal in Vaccines is Safe, end quote. In attendance at the conference was Dr. David Johnson, the state public health officer in Michigan and a member of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. He expressed reservation at having his newborn grandson vaccinated with a thimerosal-containing vaccine. But only his grandson seemed to be concerned to him, not the rest of the country's children, who continued to be vaccinated with thimerosal until public protests good to a degree that the substance was finally removed from most, but not all, vaccines. Sadly, thimerosal could have been removed from these findings as early as 1999, when the pharmaceutical companies that manufacture them offered to remove it in September. But the CDC opted to wait until 2002, after all thimerosal-containing vaccine lots had expired, to officially end its use, so the vaccine manufacturers lost no money. Around the same time as the Simpson Wood Conference, private medical consultant Dr. Barry Rumack, MD, medical toxicologist and pediatrician, was hired by the FDA to review the mercury levels in children with an eye towards childhood vaccines. According to his findings, quote, "There was no point in time from birth to approximately 18 months of age that infants were below the EPA guidelines for allowable mercury exposure. In fact, according to the models, blood and body burden levels of mercury peaked at 6 months of age at a shockingly high 120 ng per L. And to make this and put this in perspective, the CDC classifies mercury poisoning at blood levels of mercury greater than 10 ng. End quote. So Dr. Rumack notes that the FDA chose to hide this information from the public and all higher health officials. So let me just reemphasize this to all the pharmacists, the nurses, the physicians injecting this, who did this. The CDC classifies mercury poisoning when you've got definitely mercury poisoning and you can die from that. Your brain can be just completely destroyed by this. When your blood level of mercury is greater than 10, but how much did this independent doctor who was hired to go over this? He found 120. My goodness, that's 1,200% higher than what would be accounted for as mercury toxicity. And this would be in all infants. So we were putting 1,000 and actually we were putting enough mercury into every baby to cause neurological damage. And when did we start seeing these real big spikes in autism at the same time? So by the time Kennedy published his book, Thimerosal, Let the Science Speak, in 2015, thimerosal in childhood vaccines was dwindling, but was good for the people not getting the vaccines, but that wasn't voluntary. Today, any mother who takes the flu vaccine is still impacting the development of her growing child, essentially without her consent, as the risks have been belittled in public discourse. A 2012 Australian study published in the journal Toxicological and Environmental Chemistry concluded that there is a direct maternal transfer of ethyl mercury from pregnant mothers to the embryo and fetus. It remains there, and American health officials' policy for pregnant women to receive the flu shot still is in place, still promoted. And that can contain 25 micrograms of mercury. That's toxic. That's neurologically toxic. The CDC still claims that thimerosal, quote, is very safe. Kennedy's book documents over 400 peer-reviewed independent scientific studies on toxicity of thimerosal. We know that autism continued to rise even after thimerosal was removed from childhood vaccines. As mentioned, the numbers have risen even since 2018. Then was it misinformation that thimerosal was causing autism? If thimerosal had been the only toxic ingredient in childhood vaccines, perhaps we could draw that conclusion, but it isn't. Another culpable ingredient now used in most childhood vaccines and also associated with adverse neurological effects is the adjuvant aluminum. And because the viruses in vaccines have been weakened or killed, they are unable to trigger a sufficient immunological response in the body. Therefore, an adjuvant is used to hyperstimulate the immune system to start producing antibodies. Without an adjuvant, vaccines would largely be ineffective. In the year 2000, as thimerosal was being phased out, children's aluminum adjuvant burden had increased with more vaccines being added to the CDC's vaccine schedule. Aluminum compounds, either aluminum hydroxide or aluminum phosphate, are the most used adjuvants found in vaccines, including the hepatitis A, hepatitis B, DPT, Hib, pneumococcus, and the HPV vaccines, or Gardasil. Each is given to children. The HPV, now starting at 10 years, in the mid-1980s, a fully vaccinated child would have received 1,250 micrograms of aluminum before turning 18 years of age. Today, that same fully vaccinated child will receive 4,900 micrograms of aluminum, a four-fold increase. A child's actual aluminum exposure is likely much greater because aluminum sulfate is used in the purification of municipal water. Drinking water may contain levels of up to 1,000 parts of the MCGs, micrograms. An early 1996 study published in the American Academy acknowledged aluminum toxicity and adverse effects in premature infants received intravenous fluid therapy. A common argument against vaccine opponents who blame aluminum for a variety of health conditions, includes autism, is that the metal is, quote, the third most prevalent element on Earth. What they fail to acknowledge is our gastric intestinal system is rather impervious to aluminum absorption. About 2% of orally consumed aluminum from the environment is actually absorbed, and much of this is later expelled from the body by other means. However, injectable and intravenous aluminum compounds go directly entering the bloodstream and are completely different matter. This is why the use of aluminum adjuvants in vaccines carries a high neurodegenerative risk and autism risk. Aluminum neurotoxicity in preterm infants after intravenous feeding, which then contained alum, was observed back in 1987 and reported in the New England Journal of Medicine. 39% of infants receiving aluminum-containing solutions develop learning problems upon entering schools compared to those receiving aluminum-free solutions. Similar to thimerosal, aluminum is a heavy metal that contributes to oxidative stress, leading to neuroinflammatory conditions, an intense adverse reaction to the central nervous system, microglia that leads to a pathogenic result characteristic in some autistic spectrum disorder conditions. The National Library of Medicine lists 2,000 different scientific references about aluminum toxicity to human biochemistry. Aluminum's dangers, often found as alum or aluminum hydroxide in vaccines and food preparations, have been known since 1912, when the first director of the FDA, Dr. Harvey Wiley, later resigned in disgust over its commercial use in food canning, was also among the first government officials to ever warn about tobacco's cancer risks back in 1927. On tomorrow's program, I will continue this in-depth investigative report, the most comprehensive that I've ever written on this topic. All of the information I'm sharing comes from the peer-reviewed literature. And why is this important? Because now the entire world and a substantial number of scientists and physicians and public health advocates, and especially Claire Daly and the people with the European Union, are suddenly looking for the truth where before they felt that everything being given to them was quality information. In fact, they were pro-Fauci, pro-vaccine mandates, pro-everything that happened until a president of one of Pfizer's divisions was asked a simple question by a pro-vaccine and pro-COVID-19 protocol advocate. Tell us about the studies concerning getting the COVID vaccine and not being able to transmit the virus to other people. And lo and behold, the woman says, there were no studies. And so they ask a question again. And then again, nobody on that panel from the European Union Special Commission on COVID could believe that there have been no studies. But the President of the United States and Rachel Maddow and the newspapers and Fauci, everybody said, if you get the vaccine, you're not going to spread it to other people. That was the whole process of the mandates. You can't fly if you didn't get your vaccine, but you can if you did. You can go out and you can go to work if you got your vaccine, but you can if you can't. You represent a threat to society. Now we know there was no science backing any of that up. So there we are. So now, just last week, I presented a two-part program on the Progressive Commentary Hour where the European Union now invites back the people who were right all along, including Dr. David Martin, and they got a standing ovation when they made their presentation. That information is being taken back to the countries of these individual members of the European Union, but none of this has registered in the United States. So we have to take a look at, is this the first time we were deceived? No. Is there information that can show that we have been deceived all along? Yes. So, that's why I'm doing this study. Look at my results. Look at all of the information I'll be sharing on today and tomorrow's program. I want to thank you all for listening, and have a nice day. And before we complete our program today, just to let you know, I'll be continuing tomorrow for the whole hour, part two, and possibly even have to go to the third day. This is the most definitive article, as you will see, and we will post it on GaryNull.com. I've been receiving an awful lot of feedback of people who wanted to come to the anti-aging protocol program, but because they lived in other countries, they couldn't make it for legitimate reasons, they missed it. And could I do anything kind of to help them? So today's special is for you. If you care about your health, if you want to do as much as you can to slow down the aging process, if you want to be good to your body in ways that the body will really appreciate, then yes, I'm providing you with four different things that can help it. Two are documentaries. But then there's two things that you have not done before. One is the ultimate anti-aging formula. It's 120 vegan capsules. We're talking about vitamin C and E and B1 and B2 and vitamin B3, 5, 6, 12, folic acid, biotin, calcium, magnesium. Then these anti-aging superstars, L-carnosine, turmeric, resveratrol, coenzyme Q10, NADH, pine bark extract, and PQQ. So that's one thing that you have now. The second thing is a liquid. It's very good tasting. It's not sweet, it's not sour, kind of neutral. And the bad news is that the manufacturer told me 3 weeks ago that the shipment I just received would be the last shipment I would be able to get. Why? Because it took a year, 12 months, from the time I placed the order and we were out of it till it got in. He said, we're having a supply problem. A lot of the ingredients in here, these organic ingredients, are not being grown anymore in South America, in Africa, in Australia. And I said, okay, so I just have to accept that, you know, this is what it is. And so we have all the superstars in this liquid, and this is it. So when this is gone, it's gone. It's not coming back. So I'll come up with some other formula. I'll come up with something I can get the ingredients, but these are all organic. And this is a liquid, and you have one capful per day. It has the apple juice, a mangosteen, tart cherries, a pomegranate, acai, nopal, noni. It has turmeric, ginger, sea buckthorn, vitamin C, mango, papaya, pectin, guar. It has lychee, beetroot, aloe vera, goji, which is wolfberry, elderberry, cranberry, blueberry, Kakadu, Organica, the Moringa, and Baobab. And again, these are all superstars. These are the best of the best of the ingredients. Anyhow, we have all these ingredients, including graviola and macaque. So there's no product ever created like this. None. No product ever. And there couldn't be, because I know how time-consuming and how difficult it is to get this, and therefore how long it took us. It took me over a year and a half to get the ingredients together, certified organic, but now the supply chain is disrupted, so what I have in inventory, that's it. And this is the best anti-aging drink that you could get. It's called the Anti-Aging Elixir, 1 liter, large bottle. So there's two products, but then more importantly is, how do you put all this together? What kind of diet? How about fasting and exercises? Which exercises? And why is all this important? And what is the proof it works? Well, you're also going to get a copy of the multi-award-winning documentary, The Biological Aging Challenge. You're also going to get a copy of the award-winning documentary, Age is Only a Number. So all this together is the two documentaries are going to show you how it's done, proof that it works, and just making lifestyle and behavior modification choices, but showing you what a real meditation is and people being brought through a meditation class. So this is terrific. Step by step, the support system many of you need. All right? So it would cost you $265. You're only paying $132. You're saving $132, 50% off. How do you get it? Three ways. You can go online today and download it. Or you can call Neil in our vitamin closet at 646-926-5430. 646-926-5430. Or you can call and order from Diane and Sandy at 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Now, the hard part of the whole 90-day anti-aging clinical study is when people go home where there's no one guiding them, me not taking them out to the onto the road to do their workout, or sitting and having, you know, all their juices all day long, or gourmet vegan meals, or their meditation time and green time and counseling and the lectures. But you get two of the best documentaries as if you weren't there but wanted to learn. Now, I'm not doing another one of these in the fall. It just took way too much time and energy and resources to put this one together. This is number six. We've proven our point, and I think that we can show how we've reversed the aging process substantially in a group of people this time around. But for those of you who want to feel better, want to make changes within your own power and determination and discipline, now you have the package. All right, you have four things that can work on your behalf. So give a call at 877-627-5065. Thank you for listening today, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.